Today we're going to hear a lecture by environmentalist, author, and journalist Bill McKibben, delivered on November 9th of last year at the Lensing Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe and sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. McKibben was introduced by writer Bill Dubuis, author of A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. Let's go now to Bill Dubuis.
He's written a list of books longer than your arm. One of those books is The End of Nature, which appeared in 1989. And that's where I got to know Bill McKibben. I hadn't met him at that time, but I met him through that book. And boy, what a troubling book that was. It put it right there, out there in front of us about how we were changing our globe, what we needed to do. If only we had begun acting in a meaningful way back then. Boy, think of how much broader the options would be for us today. It's been a privilege watching Bill over the years and seeing how his work has changed, how his role has morphed. You also know him as the founder and really the creative spirit, one of the great creative spirits, of 350.org, and I'm sure he'll tell you about that organization tonight. It's the great climate change activism organization in the United States today. It's also, in a very meaningful way, an art activism organization. It's no small thing to put people to hard work on a difficult problem and still have fun. But 350.org, because it uses art, because it uses symbols, because it involves practice and performance and demonstration and big images and involves whole communities at a time, leads us in a kind of activism that is fun. And all of you who took part in last November's flash flood here on the Santa Fe River, organized and run by the Santa Fe Art Institute, you know how much fun that kind of thing can be. But that's not the main point I want to make about Bill. The main point I want to make has to do with what I think, and pardon me for getting a little bit heavy here, what I think is maybe the most difficult ethical question in the history of philosophy. It is said by none other than Plato that Socrates once asked Alcibiades, "Do you assent to what you know? Do you assent to what you know?" It's an oversimplification, but essentially that question is asking, do you live the truth of your beliefs? This is a problem for all of us. It's hard to do. None of us does it perfectly. It's hard for our nation as well. Think about how much work we still have to do to realize the values that are there in the Declaration of Independence. Think about the enormous gap between our understanding of climate change and the actions we're taking, or really the absence of actions that we're taking to deal with it. As I say, none of us passes this test perfectly, and nor does Bill McKibben. He's human like the rest of us, but oh my God, he sets an awfully high standard in this area. His visionary writing, which is so skilled and so high in both art and craft, has led him to the life of an activist and really an activist's activist. He's followed his questions where they lead, and that's pretty tough. I hope I'm not stealing a line from the presentation he's about to make, but yesterday he mentioned that in the last 6 months he's spent more nights in jail than he has at home. Yes. So for me, it's truly a great honor to be able to introduce to you not just one of the best writers I know, but one of the bravest, the most inspiring, the most dedicated, and one of the most important and essential individuals working in America today. Please join me in welcoming Bill McKibben.
Well, thank you for that much, much too endlessly too kind an introduction, but I thank you for it very much. I feel as even more than usual unequal to the task of getting up and speaking, and really unequal for two reasons. One is, I confess, I am a little exhausted. It wasn't actually me that said that thing about being in jail more than at home. That was an email from my wife. And I hope that she wrote it with a smile. And it has been a very long summer and fall for reasons I'll say. And I think I'm feeling tired tonight because I know that I'm in a place with friends and hence can relax a little bit. And so I apologize in advance. You're not getting me at full gallop, I'm afraid. But that's all right. You've heard such amazing stuff already tonight. And that's the other reason I feel at a loss, just to be around people of this depth of creativity and power. You know, my art is writing, and writers are a solitary and introverted bunch. You know, left really to my own devices, I would just as soon kind of sit in my room and type, you know. No singing, no dancing, no spoken word, no, you know. And so I feel unequal to the incredible example set already. That said, I have been looking forward to this day for a very long time, kind of looking ahead to it on this maniac schedule that I've been keeping. And it really, the day has been everything that I hoped it would be. I spent the first part of it in Las Vegas at the incredible home of United World College there, that sort of Hogwarts castle up on the hill, and with, you know, kids from 85 or 90 countries, and just spectacular, wonderful kids that gave one enormous hope. And then I got to go by Occupy Santa Fe. Now, I think I've been to six Occupy encampments so far. You know, got to go to Occupy Wall Street right near the start and talk and things. But I got to say, by far the most beautiful, with the full moon rising over the campfire, with the, you know, it's the 1% would envy the 99 in this case, man. It was a good thing. And of course, I'm happiest to be here for reasons that I'll talk about. I owe an enormous debt to the Santa Fe Art Institute, and so to get to be here to help them just a little bit is an enormous pleasure for me. They do incredible work, and I want to talk in a few minutes about that work in particular that y'all accomplished last year around this time. Before I do, let me take just a few moments to be dour and depressing. My work is essentially as a professional bummer-outer of other people, okay? And I'll try to just do it and get it over with, but I want to talk about why it is that the stuff we're doing together is so unbelievably important, the most important task that human beings have ever engaged in, why it matters so much that you win that fight about the San Juan generating station that people were doing that, and why it matters so much that we win this sort of larger fight around the planet. I did write the first book about climate change for a general audience 22 years ago. 22 years ago, we knew what we should, you know, most of what we needed to know. We knew that when you burned coal and gas and oil, you put carbon in the atmosphere. And we knew its molecular structure trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. We knew we had a serious problem The only thing we didn't know was exactly how hard and fast it was going to pinch. The story of the last 20 years is it's pinching harder and faster even than we imagined, and we are in just a world of hurt, in a hurting world. Just look at what's going on right now today. We've got a hurricane in the subtropics, Sean. This big makes it the sixth most active hurricane season on history, tropical storm season in history, and almost all those years have been in recent years. We've got some kind of strange, what they're calling a Medicane, a kind of hurricane striking France at the moment, completely unlikely event. Probably worst of all, there's what may be the largest storm with the deepest low pressure ever in Alaska's history as a state, just raking that shoreline this evening with storm surges that are putting people out of their homes. Meanwhile, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, we have ongoing and just horrific drought, not only in your Southwest. Texas, of course, is in a deeper drought even than the Dust Bowl, and set the record for, by a large margin, for the hottest summer any state in the Union has ever recorded this past year. Not only that, but an even really more devastating one in the Horn of Africa right now, with people just by the hundreds of thousands or millions facing famine. And because once that water evaporates up into the atmosphere, it's going to come down, we're seeing just epic flooding in place after place after place. 6 or 7 weeks ago, it was my state in Vermont that took the brunt. We set in the tail end of Hurricane Irene the staggering new rainfall records across the state and across upstate New York, where old one-day rainfall records were broken by 25 and 30 and 60%, you know. Just almost unbelievable. This is a new planet that this is happening on. It's no longer the Holocene. We've come out of the Holocene. If you are in Bangkok tonight, one of the great cities of the world, the kind of cradle of Buddhist civilization, people desperately trying to figure out how to get out of the way of floodwaters and the worst monsoon storms ever recorded there, just raising the water across that city day by day by day. All of this has happened because we've raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree so far, globally averaged. We've added about 0.75 watts of extra solar energy per square meter of the Earth's surface. Neither of those figures sound all that big, one degree or 0.75 watts, but it turns out the Earth was a very finely balanced place, that the Holocene was a period of wonderful stability that we have now kicked over, and we're out of the Holocene in the lifetimes of the people in this room, really in the last couple of decades, and we're on to something else, and the only question is how deep into that something else we're going to go. There's already almost certainly another degree of warming in the pipeline from carbon we've already emitted. The oceans will hold that heat for a while, a couple of decades, but it expresses back out into the atmosphere. The climatologists who have been right about everything so far are robust in their consensus that if we do not get our act together soon, and by getting our act together, I mean stop burning coal and gas and oil far more quickly than any government is planning to at the moment, that if we don't do that, by the time the high school students in this audience are old, the temperature will have risen 4 or 5 or 6 degrees, and most of that will be locked in the next few decades. Those are not temperatures that civilizations can deal with. Last year, a team of agronomists at University of Washington and Stanford put out a powerful paper in which they said, from this point forward, we think that grain yields, because corn and soybean and wheat all evolved in the Holocene just like us, we think that each degree increase in temperature from here on in will lead to about a 10% decline in grain yields, okay? Already in the last 2 years, because we've had these erratic harvests and droughts, grain prices have spiked about 70%, and about 200, 250 million people have been added to the rolls of the malnourished on this planet. But think about, you can do the math, you can do the kind of analysis in your own head. You all know enough about the world to try and imagine what it will mean for social justice and peace and women's issues and food security and development of any kind to be in a world with 20 or 30% fewer calories than the one we have now. We can't let that happen. We cannot let that happen. We can't let it happen, in part because the people who are being hit first and hardest are the ones who have done the least to cause this. It's not only the greatest practical dilemma we've ever faced, it's the greatest ethical quandary we've ever wandered into. And so we've got to keep it from happening. That's it. We've got to keep it from happening. And how to do that? The thought for a long time, really for many years of the last 20, was that we would keep it from happening by having our scientists and so on sit down with our politicians and explain the problem to them, and they would act. Say, the worst thing that ever happened in the world is acting, is happening. We know the steps we need to take to get out of it. We need to put a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. We need to spur the transition to renewable energy. We need to do these things that our engineers have made possible. Let's get to it. That theory probably should have worked. But it didn't work, and the reason was that we forgot to figure in that the fossil fuel industry was going to be bellowing in the other ear of those politicians, bellowing some mix of threat and promise that would drown out reason and prevent action. The fossil fuel industry is the most profitable enterprise that human beings have ever engaged in by a large margin. Exxon announced its quarterly profits last week, $10 billion for the quarter. They made more money last quarter than any company in the history of money. Okay? And you all know enough about our political system to know it takes but a small vanishing percentage of that wealth in order to warp the process, especially if all you want to do is delay things for a while, keep action from happening. And that's what they're happy to do, even if it means the kind of trouble that we already see and that we're heading into. So, in a sense, no use complaining about it. That's the reality that we face. The challenge then is how we beat them. And it's not going to be with money, because we're never going to have enough. Okay? It's going to be by finding other currencies to work in. It's going to be by building movements big enough and powerful enough to start to matter, to start to throw a little bit of fear into the people who are willing to do what they're doing now. I talk about this as if I know what I'm doing, and I really don't. As I say, I'm a writer by trade. I have no real idea how to go build movements. We've been completely making it up as we went along. We started this thing, 350.org, in January of 2008 because our greatest climatologist, Jim Hansen at NASA, and his team put out a paper that both thrilled and horrified us. Probably the most important scientific paper of the millennia to date. It said, we now know enough about carbon to know how much is too much in the atmosphere. They said, any value for carbon greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Very strong language for scientists to use. Stronger still, if you know that wherever you are today, Santa Fe, San Juan, Santiago, you name it, the atmosphere is 393 parts per million CO2 and rising more than 2 parts per year. Okay, we're already way too high. That's why, you know, Vermont and Thailand drown and Texas and Africa burn, you know. were already way too high. And so it was a horrifying paper to read. And on the other hand, for those of us who'd been sort of trying to kick around how we might do sort of global organizing, there was one thing about it that was kind of powerful, and that was the number. The difficulty with trying to organize around the first truly global problem the planet has ever faced is that the globe is a very big place, you know, and everybody on it insists on speaking their own language, all right, which makes it hard to organize. You wouldn't normally choose a wonky scientific data point as your rallying cry, but Arabic numerals cross those linguistic boundaries. 350 means the same thing in everywhere you go on this planet. Okay, so we said, well, we'll try and see if we can. And that was good that we had one advantage because we didn't have much else, no money. And the we in this case was me and seven students at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I teach. Seven, however, being a good number, really, if you had to have a number, because there are seven continents. So each one took one, you know. And the guy who took the Antarctic also had to take the internet, okay? It's kind of its own continent. And we set off to organize. This was January of 08. And the first thing we did was said, because we were trying to think, I was trying to think in sort of terms about how you take these things and make the world kind of see them. You know, though we were very and are very tied to science in a sense, that's what we do, that's what we're based out of, that's what the bottom of this story is. The environmental movement's been altogether too good at trying to appeal to the side of people that the whatever half of your brain it is that likes, you know, bar graphs and pie charts and things, and much less good at appealing to whatever the other half is that likes actual things, you know, and stuff. And so we were like trying to figure out how to. What we decided to do is we'd take a day, almost like a kind of holiday, like a festival, and try to take this number and put it every place out around the world. Could we do this? And we held training camps for young people, like one in Turkey for Central Asia, one in the Caribbean. We did one in Johannesburg that brought young people from pretty much every country in Africa, one or two. Most had never been on an aeroplane or been out of their country, but they were good organizers, born organizers. We said, every place we went, we said, okay, you're going to have to figure out something to do on the 24th of October, 2009. So that's like these, you know, youth allies here in Santa Fe. They're a perfect example. Figure out what you're going to do. You know? We weren't telling people, we weren't organizing. You can't organize the whole world, but we just like, we were having like, well, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so it's like we were having a potluck supper, the kind of Methodist sacrament, you know, we were engaging in. And everybody would, we'd set the date and everybody would bring their thing, you know. We didn't know how well it would work, and we got a sense it was going to work well 2 days early, October 22nd. We were sitting down in a borrowed office in Lower Manhattan, you know, the eight of us, laptops open, doing the kind of last-minute stuff. And this call comes, and it's from a 17-year-old girl that we'd worked with in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. She'd been to one of these training camps. She said, you know what, the government, she was almost in tears, government's taken away our permit for Saturday. We can't do it on Saturday. Ethiopia, not the nicest government always in the world. So we're doing it today before they can stop us, and we're so sorry, and we don't mean to be jumping the gun. We don't want to spoil it for people. We were so hoping to do it the same day as everybody else, and we have 10,000 kids out in the street right now chanting 350. And I was like, Lily, don't worry about the date. It's okay, you know. And that was the beginning of this astonishing kind of weekend, and before it was over, there had been 5,100 demonstrations in 181 countries, and CNN called it the most widespread day of political activity in the planet's history, and it was extraordinarily beautiful for a number of reasons, one of which was, and this was very important for me to see, I'd spent half my life having people tell me that environmentalism was something that rich white people did when they didn't have any other problems to worry about, and that if you had to like worry about your daily bread or whatever, you wouldn't be an environmentalist, and on and on and on. And it just turns out to be nonsense. Most of the people we worked with around the world were poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the world is made up of, you know? And oddly enough, care just as much about the future as anybody else, maybe more, because the future is bearing down hard on you if you're in those categories, you know? And so it was amazing to see, from the very poorest and most remote parts of the world to the middle of big cities. We had 300 big demonstrations in China and 300 in India and, you know, pretty much every place in the world. So that was one great revelation. And the other was just how creative and beautiful and powerful people would be, the things that they came up with to do, to take this number, which had the virtue, as it turned out, of being empty of meaning, okay? An empty vessel into which people could pour all kinds of creativity and passion of all kinds. And people were remarkable. Thousands of churches around the world rang their church bells 350 times that day, you know, and just on and on and on. Just every, and so much, you know, it was, what people did was art, in place after place after place. And it made me think, made me realize that this was such a fine idea to just kind of turn people loose. And it made me and us want to do more and more and more and more with art. I'm going to talk about a little project that you guys all helped with last year that we did. We've kept doing these huge global days of action. We did one in the fall of 2010. It was a global work party, people putting up solar panels and digging community gardens, doing cool things all over the world. It was even bigger. It was like 7,400 of these in every country but North Korea. We did another one of these big things this fall, bicycle-based, this moving planet thing, incredibly beautiful all over the world again. But last year in December, we wanted to sort of get people focused on these things because the UN was having another of these big talks. And we said, let's try to do a little more pointedly, try to get enlist artists and people who are interested in art, and we'll do 20 or so things around the world. And the only kind of condition we're going to try to put on them is, because this is a global problem, we want things on a scale that help people understand the idea that we live on a planet. I'm convicted of the idea that we sometimes forget that the world is so cozy and familiar in the places where we live that it's hard for us to remember sometimes that we're on a planet, just like Jupiter or Saturn or something, a round ball floating in space that has to obey physical laws and to which things happen and so on and so forth. And so I said, let's try to do things that are big enough that you could see them from outer space. You know, that would, and I found a wonderful satellite company in Colorado called Digital Globe that said, okay, we can do that, and donated $500,000 worth of satellite time to make it possible. And so people, you know, we worked with artists around the world, and they started coming up with really beautiful, powerful things. I was in Spain, usually using human bodies as their canvas. That's Brighton Beach in England. Tom York, the lead singer of Radiohead, got very excited by all of this. And so he was able to summon quite instantly on his Facebook page thousands of fans to come down to the beach, and he had them all in blue raincoats, and they were forming a King Canute there, trying to hold back the waters of the rising ocean, you know, on the... doing something wrong with this machine as usual because it's not advanced. Oh, there we go. That was actually just this artist out in the middle of Iceland with food coloring. It became very iconic in Iceland. This thing became just one of the most loved images. Very, very powerful. That's in the Dominican Republic. It's thousands of people with their bodies forming a house that people are having to leave through the roof as the floodwaters rise, you know. That's a big scarab beetle in Egypt. And then those are solar panels and solar collectors, people making them there in the desert. And I think that's Brazil, but I can't remember. It's, you know, just incredibly beautiful things that people were figuring out how to do wherever they are. a great eagle in Los Angeles, and that quite amazing thing in Australia, and there were place after place. But I confess that of all of them, and I'm not just saying this because I'm here, this was my very favorite. It was so beautiful. And it was so beautiful in so many ways. I've seen kind of the videos of it being made and the kind of amazing combination of commotion. And my friend David Abram, the great writer who lives here, sent me an email that day just saying this was like the greatest mashup of all time, sort of all the kind of communications technologies and things in one place. You know, that there are Native Americans doing dances that date back thousands of years, and above them there are helicopters, and above that there are satellites taking pictures, and it's kind of this mashup of the old world and the postmodern world and every other thing, and incredibly beautiful and incredibly hopeful, and I am so grateful to y'all for doing that. Images from this all over the world, and just been remarkable to see. That's Rooftop in New York, and oh, that was a particularly pleasant, I love this. This is one of our friends, an aerial artist named Daniel Dancer, and those are thousands upon thousands of Indian school children making an elephant fleeing the rising waters, and I'm just going to flip through. These are not from these days. These are just a few random pictures of the 30 or 1,000 or so in our Flickr account that you're welcome to go look at, but just showing sort of people figuring out how to do interesting art of all kinds. And there are thousands of videos that come flying in all the time. And, you know, just amazing work that people are figuring out all the time. And stuff that makes me so, so happy every time I see it. People were asking me today, you know, how I kept from despairing sometimes. Because the science of this is very dark. And the reason that incredible, like, lanterns that just fill up, you know, with the hot air and float out into. It's because there are so many million good people engaged in this work every place around the world, you know? And it's enough always to make you happy as can be and almost as sad as can be at the same time, and just, you know, and never know whether it be in smiles or tears. Or that was that very first day on October 24th in Soweto. It's in Soweto, in the black township that was the, you know, heartland of resistance to apartheid. They did 350 bungee jumps that day, okay? But the important part was, they sent us a note. They strung the bungee line between the cooling towers of a defunct coal-fired power plant, and they sent us a note saying, this is the highest and best use for coal-fired power plants going forward. So I cannot wait for the day when that San Juan generating station is, you know, the official land of enchantment bungee jumping emporium, you know. It will be a great day. Now, these things are incredibly beautiful and very helpful, and they have helped put this thing on the map. When we went to that Copenhagen big climate summit, okay, we got 117 nations to agree to this 350 target, which we thought was pretty good, having started 18 months earlier with 7 college kids, 117 nations to agree. But they were the wrong 117 nations, okay? They were all the poorest and most vulnerable ones, and all the rich addicts led by us did nothing. Watched the thing fizzle, watched it fade away. It was as depressing as I've ever seen. And it made me realize that, important as all this is, and it is vitally important, this kind of education, ongoing, beautiful education that gets at people's hearts and souls, we also have to be willing to do more and be a little edgier sometimes and do, in a sense, different kinds of art too. Earlier this summer, I kind of put out the call with some friends for people to come to Washington to do some civil disobedience in front of the White House about this pipeline. And I think you all know about this pipeline, and I won't. Just the reason it was so important is because it connects up to these tar sands in Canada, which are the second largest pool of carbon on Earth. Only the Saudi oil fields are bigger. If you could burn them all tonight, which thank God you can't, but if you could torch it all off tonight, okay, you would increase the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from 393 parts per million to about 540 parts per million. Okay. Jim Hansen at NASA and his team said in late spring, if we heavily develop these tar sands, it is essentially game over for the climate. Okay, which you would think would be enough in a rational world for people to say, okay, then we should not develop these tar sands. But there are a couple of $1 trillion worth of oil up there, so people are bent on developing them. And they would have won without any doubt, you know. The odds in favor of this pipeline were 1,000 to 1 6 months ago. But we decided that because the president himself will get to make this call without Congress in the way, they need a presidential permit of that this is in the national interest because it crosses the national border. We decided that we would go there and see what we could do. Well, I had no idea how many people would be willing to come. As it turns out, over 2 weeks, there were 1,253 people who got arrested. It was the biggest civil disobedience action in this country in 35 years. And in a way, I just want to see this, since we're talking about the pipeline, I just want you to see this amazing mural done locally here. I'll keep that up so you can see it to give you just a sort of visual reminder of what we're talking about. In a way, what we were doing, what civil disobedience is performance art, okay? It's an attempt to make people understand through that other part of their brain how important something is. It's an attempt to say this thing is important enough that I'm willing to make this kind of moral witness about it. And I got to say, I did a certain amount of choreographing for this one. I said, if you want to come take part, we need you in a necktie or a dress, okay? And there was a reason for that. My hope was that we could show people that we were not in any way the radicals here. Radicals are people who are willing to alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere, who are willing for money to change the atmosphere. Exxon is a hotbed of radicals, okay? By this definition, if your local utility is determined to keep a coal-fired power plant going, it is behaving in a radical fashion, all right? And by contrast, those of us whose main wish is to keep the world something like the one we were born into are pretty much the definition of conservatives. And we needed a way to get that across, okay? And so that was one of the ways. The other way that was important was that we said, you know what? We don't want college kids, young people, to be the cannon fodder for this event, this arrest. In the first place, because they have not spent anywhere near as many years dumping carbon into the atmosphere as some of us, and hence it's less their responsibility. And in the second place, because, you know, if you're 18 in our economy right now, an arrest record may not actually be the best thing to put on your resume. But once you're past a certain point, you know, what are they going to do to you? And so it was... And so it was with great pleasure that I watched what happened. People of all ages did come, but we didn't ask people, how old are you? Because that would be rude, you know? But we did ask, who was president when you were born? Okay. And the two biggest cohorts were from the FDR and the Truman administrations. And on the last day, there was a man 86 years old from the Harding administration arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II veteran, handle with care. Okay? And that was fantastic, powerful. That was a kind of powerful art that people were making. And it should, I was thinking of it so much when that powerful, powerful speaker, when Autumn was speaking from Youth Allies, it was really good for a while to see older people owning up, standing up, doing what needed doing, taking that kind of responsibility. That was powerful. We had more art this past weekend. We were returning to Washington. We needed to sort of go back, and the question was to do what? And you know what? It just sort of going and standing around in a gang and listening to speeches, the kind of rally thing, seemed not enough. So what can we do? I said, let's circle the White House with people, or let's at least see if we can. That'll be a kind of beautiful image. Now, we didn't know if we could. All my young colleagues were all on Google Earth trying to count how many people you need. But we actually had no idea, and apparently no one had managed to do it since at least the 60s. And so really there was no... But we were hopeful that if we, you know, we did our best, we'd get enough people that if we, like, stretched out like this, we would just make it around. In the event... It turned out that so many people came that they were stacked about four or five deep, shoulder to shoulder, all the way around. And it was a very beautiful thing, you know. I said, as we were going out, I said, you know what, depending on your mood here today, you're welcome to sort of think of it as either a big O-shaped hug for the president, you know, or a kind of symbolic house arrest, you know? Those are the possibilities. But we were doing our best to be completely... Part of the performance here was to be completely... to sort of swallow some of our... Be completely respectful. Every banner that people had was just a quote from President Obama in 2008. All the many amazing things he said, you know? Time to end the tyranny of oil. In my administration, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow and the planet will begin to heal. Wonderful stuff. And the point we were trying to make was, A, if you don't mean it, you shouldn't say it because people believe you, you know, me included. And B, we're still hoping that that guy's in there someplace, you know, and that we can kind of help liberate him. It was so beautiful on such a beautiful day with such magic sort of feeling that I'm, you know, half allowing some tiny part of my brain to think that we even have some outside possible chance at winning this fight. Now, of course, winning won't look exactly the way, you know, one wants it to, you know, with the bold declaration that there'll be no more, you know, carbon or whatever. Winning will be some, you know, it'll be like a decision to delay this thing for a couple of years and study it much more intently, and that'll be enough to kill the thing, probably. And it'll be a tremendous victory if it happens, and you'll be able to know it's a tremendous victory because the stock price of TransCanada will drop in half overnight. They've already mowed the corridor. Their performance art has been to mow the corridor where they're going to put this pipe down for 1,700 miles across the heartland of the U.S. and to bring the pipe in from Canada and have it laid out in sections ready to go the second. That's how confident they are. But I continue to hold out some small hope that we may beat them, that they may not get to do that anytime soon. And any kind of thing like that would be a signal, tonic victory, a reminder that when people get together and firmly, politely, but firmly, say what has to happen, that sometimes it does, that we can find other currencies in which to work. Let me just end by saying, you know, if I was a great organizer, I'd just tell you these stories and stop, and you'd be inspired and ready to go. And I, you know, I'm not a great organizer. I'm a writer. And the duty of writers is to best they can tell the truth. And the truth is, this may not work. It may not work with the pipeline. The whole thing may not work. There are scientists who think that we have waited too long to get started and that this heating is kind of unstoppable. And they may be right. The best science at the moment indicates we still have some kind of window, not to stop global warming, but to keep it from getting any worse than it has to. But that window is closing and closing rapidly. There are political scientists who think it's impossible, that the odds are simply too high, too much money on the other side. They may well be right. If you were a betting person, you'd probably be wise to bet that way because we've been losing for 20 years, okay? But I think it's a bet you're not allowed to make. I think the only moral thing that a morally awake person can do when the worst thing that ever happened is happening is get up in the morning and try to figure out how to change those odds a little bit, even with no guarantee of success at all. And if I can't guarantee success, and I can't, the only thing I can guarantee, because I've spent so much time in the last few years in constant motion around the planet, spewing carbon behind me, is that there are people everywhere who are completely willing to fight as hard as they can to the end of this. And wonderfully, hauntingly, many, many of those people, most of them are in places that have done almost nothing to cause this problem. And yet they're willing to be in real solidarity with those of us who have to work side by side. It's always an honor to be in those rooms, you know, filled with those people who are willing to go to work. And it is a great, great, great honor to be in this room tonight and just to be able to say thank you for that which you have already done and to say thank you in advance for all that you will do in the future and to say, though I can't guarantee that we win, I will look forward to fighting shoulder by shoulder with you as long as we can. Thank you guys very, very much. Very much. Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you all and thank the Art Institute very, very much.
We've been listening to a lecture with Bill McKibben, author, journalist, and environmentalist, founder of 350.org. It was delivered on the 9th of November of last year at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. For more information, you can go to 350.org. And for the Santa Fe Art Institute, you can go to sfai.org.